This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good. Spring is coming. We just had a couple weeks ago was spring solstice, so looking forward to the better weather.
Oh, yeah. It's been really rough on you down there in Los Angeles.
I know.
had a rough winter down there. Oh, my. All right. Well, tell us a story. What's new in the world?
Well, you know, we've got a couple of questions that have come in that really piqued my interest. So one of them has to do with a son who has decided doesn't want to go to college. So a parent's trying to figure out, you know, what to think about this, what to do. Another question is about the 10 paid dates. What if the culture in the country is such that that 10 paid dates may not be culturally acceptable? And why are some things considered manly? So we've got, and we've got a couple more after that. So let's just get right down to them. Dr. Lyle, you ready?
Sure. I'm ready.
All right. Dr. Lyle, my son is a junior in high school. He recently experienced an upsurge in anxiety because of mounting school pressure. Mm-hmm. He has two diagnosed learning disabilities as well as attention weaknesses, which makes school doubly hard for him. He attends the same college prep high school that his older brother did and is required to take advanced placement as well as a college readiness class there. In addition to this, he holds down a 16-hour-per-week part-time job, which he enjoys, and is getting a lot of positive feedback from. Recently, he's come to me saying that he doesn't feel like he's ready to go away to a 4-year college like his older brother did after high school. When I asked him what he might want to do after high school, he says he doesn't want to think about it. He doesn't feel like he's ready to go abroad on a gap year trip like his father has proposed. He says he might want to work full-time at the fast food restaurant where he currently works part-time, but that thinking about the future causes him anxiety. My son's father is concerned about his son's anxiety and wants to get him on anti-anxiety meds as soon as possible. I've read the possible side effects of SSRIs, and I'm not excited about the prospect of my kid being on them. What are your thoughts on the situation? My son will be 18 in less than a year. At that point, I'll have no influence over whether or not he takes it. Thanks in advance. He's due to see the psychiatrist next week.
Oh, geez. I hope this we're getting to this question right away and this isn't two months later.
This was sent today.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I would definitely not go to the psychiatrist. I would instead, there's no rush on such a big decision. If I was a parent, I would recommend that you read the book by Robert Whittaker called Anatomy of an Epidemic. And not only that, I would actually, if your son can't read it, which he may not be interested in reading it, I guess the first thing I would do is I would read that book myself, and then I would decide whether I would take that son to the psychiatrist, and I probably wouldn't. So there's no rush on the psychiatrist. We can just wait for 6 weeks while these parents get a hold of this book, read it, and then become a better informed consumer looking out for their son's best interest. So that's number one. So I don't care what the grandpa thinks, and that the grandpa thinks that the kid needs medication. The grandpa doesn't know a damn thing about the effects of these medications. So that is absurd. So we'll just table that obviously grandpa's trying to do what's in the kid's best interest because he sees that the kid is anxious, but grandpa doesn't know anything about neuroscience, obviously. So anyway, so that's where we start. Second of all, in terms of your son, struggling in school and not wanting to go to college, good for him. This is exactly what he should be doing. So, in fact, he shouldn't be in a college prep sequence right now with advanced placement things required, for goodness sakes. Not unless that this kid is a triple-plated genius and despite his learning disabilities that he's sailing through and doing fine. Why are we suffering? Okay, so this is a bunch of high-class dominance hierarchy climbing on the part of the parents trying to do what's in their son's best interest to position him to be competitive in a university setting for which he's not destined, at least not anytime in the near future. So I would find a way to roll that back as much as possible within, you know, obviously if he's in school and integrated socially with those kids and likes it, fine, then he's going to stay there. But it sounds like he's a junior right now. Yeah, he's a junior in high school. So yeah, he's going to stay there, but I would have him taking the minimum of any high school requirement courses to graduate. And I would just completely, I mean, high school education is a joke, folks. It has no, it's not, quote, preparing us for anything. It's just a demonstration of your IQ. And so I definitely would not be having this kid in anything that's, quote, college prep if we can help it. Just let him have a good time in high school. He's obviously got some conscientiousness and some ambitionship in there to be productive, which is beautiful. So we don't have a kid that's staring at a video screen 50 hours a week. We have a kid that enjoys working and being productive and is socially integrated with his job situation and is doing well. That's fabulous. That's just what the Stone Age brain wants, is to get out there and be productive as a young adult. So then he wants to work full time when he graduates, which is great. My goodness, this is fabulous. So wants to work full time. That's terrific. To let the young man work, let him find a productive spot there for a while where he grows up, gets a little bit older, gets a little bit wiser, a little bit smarter, that brain's maturing, and let him just be a productive citizen. That's exactly what he wants to do. No rush at all. He may work 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. No problem. If he winds up going back to school for something specific where it's worth it to him, he can see how the dots connect on a line between the school and the financial career outcome that now may make sense to him at 23. Terrific. Now we go back to school at 23. We're way older, wiser, more seasoned, and we're a more capable human. And we've got a reason to be there rather than just a glorified fitness indicator. We're not even know what we're doing or why. So I think that's the solution. So my solutions would be, number one, cancel the psychiatric appointment. Number two, get Robert Whitaker's book, Anatomy of Epidemic, and read it. Then number three, if somehow that doesn't convince you, call me for an appointment. You'll get more of this. You'll need a half hour appointment. In half an hour, I can get a lot of words out. So the anxiety that the young man has is undoubtedly part of his nature. He's got some conscientiousness in there, and that's fine. No problem. That's not going to kill anybody, and we're not going to be in there drugging it, for goodness sakes. So we let him grow up and let him grow up where he's comfortable doing things at a pace that he's comfortable doing it. And so that's what my recommendation would be, and absolutely have him aim. You know, we don't know if he might change his mind next spring, and next spring he may decide that he's ready to go off to the JC. Fine. That's fine. I think a JC, junior college, for a young person like this would be a very fine stepping stone. Clearly, he does not feel ready to take on the big university like his older sibling. That's no problem at all. No shame in that whatsoever. So I would say good idea is to let him stay where he is, let him work full time, let him grow up a little bit, and then let him find his way.
Fantastic. Hopefully, the looks like the mother sent this in today. Hopefully they listen.
Yeah. Oh, it's mom. Okay. Got it. Yeah. That's what you do.
Fantastic.
Don't be putting this kid on anti-anxiety meds. I think that I, in my opinion, that's a mistake. And so my recommendation is to don't take my word for it. Read Whitaker and then make up your own mind.
Mm-hmm.
But we can certainly wait for a few weeks while the parents become educated about what I believe is a major fiasco. So there's no rush in getting that kid in front of a psychiatrist who is well-meaning, but I believe misguided. So let's take our time and do this thing right.
Fantastic. All right, Dr. Lyle, now we're going to talk about dating and tent paid dates. I know we've dedicated a lot of time on tent paid dates, and every time we do, I get a lot of interesting questions about it. It's a very curious topic for both men and women. I get a lot of disappointed comments by men, you know, and a lot of other comments about women. See if there's another way around it. So you've laid out the logic in previous episodes. So this is a question that I've gotten that I hadn't read before, but I've gotten when I talk to people. So it has to do with whether the culture supports this 10 paid dates rule. So Dr. Lyle, I'm a 32-year-old female who's been single for about 2 months by now. I've had three long-term relationships in my life. I've met my previous partners either at university or at work, and therefore was exposed to them a lot of times and already knew them very well by the time we decided to commit to a relationship. Therefore, I have very little experience in dating, but as I'd like to have some children in the near future, I'm thinking of looking for a new partner more actively now. Online dating, taking language or material arts classes, where I could potentially meet someone new. To avoid men that are into casual mating, I'm planning to apply this 10 paid date strategy, which seems like a brilliant concept. But there's one problem that I think could come up given my cultural circumstances. I live in Germany, and here gender equality is very integrated in the culture. It's the norm that after a date, people split the bill or pay alternately. I'm also a well-earning engineer, so I think I would feel guilty for expecting to let the man pay for me 10 times in a row. I also don't want to signal that I try to take financial advantage of my dating partner. Therefore, I'd like to ask if 10 paid dates still make sense if I offer to pay, for example, every second or third date, as long as the man pays 10 times in a row or 10 times total. Or would this signal to the male that he's fancier than me and then disqualify me as a long-term partner?
Okay, these are really good questions. This is very thoughtful. And so I'm aware that there's some cultural differences out there. So let's begin with the first salvo is that in general, it's going to be the man asking the woman out. So it's legitimate if the male asks the woman out that he should be expecting to pay. Now, so I would, you can certainly offer to pay, but I would be watching for those signals and I would expect him to turn it down. If he doesn't turn it down, that's red flag number one. Okay, so that's fine. So that's how I would manage that little cultural issue. I also think that what she's describing, I wouldn't be looking for 10 paid dates at this point. The point isn't 10 paid dates. The point is 10 exposures where we're not getting the guy, he's not getting into your sexuality. So this is the notion here is that we're slowing the action down and making the price higher, either monetarily, which isn't really the biggest issue, but it's really time and energy wise. And so so if we have, as she says, her cultural, culture can be somewhat different and she makes good money. And so therefore I can see exactly this kind of strategy, like, he should be sort of 2-to-1 on him and you're being offering and accommodating. And if you like this guy, then you're willing to spend your time to go out with him again and he with you. But he should, you know, be looking to signal ways to provision you, interesting things to do, ways to entice you to be going out again, et cetera. That's fine. And you don't have to stand your ground on, crossing your arms, expecting him to pay. The notion of 10 pay dates fits better in the United States than it does in the situation that you're describing. And yet, we should still be looking for signals of male willingness to provision. And furthermore, the most important part of this is we're not giving him access to sexual activity anytime soon. So that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to smoke out the fact that he's going to be frustrated. He's expecting to get into bed with you on date 3 or date 4, where we would expect him to be frustrated with this, and we don't have a problem with it. This is where you have to conjure up some disagreeableness, where we're just like, no, I really like you. Yeah, just take it slow. No problem. And if he disappears in a huff after date 3 or date 4 or date 5, we got our answer. And so that's fine. That's not a problem. That you did not make a mistake there and pass up on some future husband and father of your children that was really into you. You smoked out a casual mating strategy player. So that's how I would look at the situation. And yes, I think in Scandinavia it would probably also be similar. I'm aware that there's some differences there. So yeah, mm-hmm. Play it this way. In other words, the whole idea is to play conservative and take your sweet time and make the cost higher. In the U.S., you make it higher in terms of both finances, which doesn't have to be high. It doesn't have to be expensive. But the notion is that, hey, he's courting you and he's provisioning you for your time. Which is what's very valuable here. And we are also making sure that we send a strong signal that you're not a casual mating strategy target if you don't intend to be. Okay, so it's one thing if women want to go out and have a good time and engage in casual mating, that's completely, hey, listen, everybody's adults and everybody do what they want. But the notion here, this person is looks like a very pair-bond oriented young lady, 32 years old, 3 long-term relationships, highly intelligent, a lot of stability there. This doesn't look like a person who would be real interested in being burned by casual mating strategy. It's not the worst thing in the world if you are. It's just that you don't. We just assume not. And so, this is the strategy that still holds in exactly with the very same logic.
Fantastic. Yeah, I wonder, I think I've definitely heard this question from people who live in more, I guess, more progressive cities. So I wonder if mm-hmm. this is going to become more common as the cities get larger and there's more of that cultural shift.
And there's all kinds of things going on. But the game remains the same. That the male is trying to minimize the cost per sex act in terms of time, energy, and money. And the female ultimately is looking to maximize the cost per sex act, generally speaking. So the female's engineered, ultimately the cost per sex act becomes, gee, I'd like to have a couple of kids. It's going to take X amount of sex acts to make that happen. And I want the guy to have a really good job, and then I want him to provision these children for the next 25 plus years. Okay? So clearly, unconsciously, what is going on and how these organisms are designed is the male is trying to minimize CPSA and the female is trying to maximize CPSA. So, of course, as birth control has made the biological cost per sex act a lot less, there is then, the behavior has shifts towards a lower barrier to entry, so to speak. Yeah. Okay. So of course we see that has happened and it will continue to happen along some gradient and it'll reach some equilibrium with respect to specific cultures and specific genetics that reside inside the people in those cultures. But the basic dynamic will remain, which is that there will be the male genes against female genes working across this matrix. And the wise female who's is not in it for short-term the short-term pleasure of casual mating, that individual would be is well instructed to be disagreeable enough to put up a barrier to the point where the male is frustrated if he's pursuing exclusively casual mating, which it's very likely that he is and doesn't know it. So that's the point, and that's never going to change. So certainly withholding to date three, I don't care what culture it is, that's not very much time and energy on the male's part. You see, that's like, wow. So when I go away on a business trip and you hang out with, you meet some guy at a bar when you and the girls go out for a drink, then you meet him the next night and then you meet him one more night, then you're having sex with the guy 4 days into my business trip. That's what I'm going to infer from the female who's willing to go to bed with me on date three after she's just met me. I'm picking up evidence that there's not much in the way of defense here, so therefore the fidelity probability is relatively low. Okay? So if it turns out that I'm running into defenses that take me, 3 weeks to get there, 3 weeks and 10 meetings to get there, then it's like, okay, well now I'm a lot safer. Okay? And therefore I think that's a more legitimate fidelity cue to be sending to the male.
Hmm. Well, I mean, so a question that pops up when you say this is, let's say I'm a six, and I'm dating somebody who would be say what, a seven or an eight, if I'm in pair bond strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. It means that they're going to wait 10 paid dates with me, but they're not going to wait 10 paid dates with the nine who's signaling slight amount of investment, right? They're going to wait four or five, maybe.
Right. So this is why, for example, this is all the more reason that when you're a male, you're reading these cues. Okay, so there's a lot of things happening here. So if the female rolls over quickly and easily, it's a signal to the male that he's fancier, and it's a signal to the male that also she's effectively not trustworthy with people that are of his caliber, and so as a result, it's like, whoa. Well, there's going to be plenty of competition. I'm interested in her, so guys that are about like me are going to be interested in her. And if guys that are about like me can hit on her for a short period of time and get laid, wow, this is not trustworthy. Whereas if a guy like me, let's suppose I'm a six hitting on an eight, and that eight is defending the eggs, just as she should, then what we're going to find is I see her defending the eggs, but she's interested. So she eventually warms up and we eventually get someplace. Now what am I thinking? Okay. I'm thinking, well, the sevens aren't going to be falling all over her. They'll be interested, but they're not going to be as excited. The nines aren't going to be falling all over her. In other words, people aren't going to be, it's guys like me that would be most excited and really willing to push hard. The other guys are not the gradient, the prize isn't as great. And if they try a drive-by shooting, I can see that she's resistant to the casual mating strategy. So therefore, of course, if she could get hit weak knees delta, we all would know that that would be possible. However, at least I know that the guys like me that would really be pursuing hard because she's a prize relative to me are going to run into resistance. If it turns out that I don't run into resistance, I've got a hell of a lot of competition. I want to see to it that at least competition at about my level is going to run into these barriers. Okay. Of course, we know that, the Highlander isn't going to run into the barrier. Okay. So that's a TV show from way back. Of course, people that are vastly superior to her may not run into a barrier. We know that that's true, but we also know that they're probably not all that interested. Why is the Highlander hitting on an eight? Okay, he's got to be down on his luck, broke, and with some rotting teeth. That's the only way that happened. Okay, all right. So hopefully that logic makes some sense.
Well. Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of maybe I'm making an incorrect inference. So I hope you'll correct me.
Sure.
But it reminds me, a long time ago, someone sent me an article of, what's his name? David Spade, actor in Hollywood, was out with his girlfriend at the time. And they were with a bunch of other celebrities. And Jack Nicholson starts hitting on his girlfriend. And David Spade doesn't say anything, like just doesn't defend her, doesn't defend the relationship or nothing. And he was quoted later as saying, and I just pulled this article up when you were saying this, but he's quoted later as saying that she got mad at him because he didn't stick up for her. And his response was, baby, I've been in this town long enough to know when I'm outranked. Like, he's fancier than me. You're either going to go out with him or you're not.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. That was an interesting strategy on his part. And obviously, well, the whole thing's interesting that he got to find out where she really stood. And and so that was a little interesting calibration process took place when that relationship got under a little bit of stress. So, oh well, entertaining to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sounds like he had kind of a pair bonder who was not really that impressed. And just because somebody's fancy doesn't mean that just because somebody is fancier than you doesn't mean that it's your mate's type at all.
Oh,
okay. It's not that objective. And also women's sexual preferences can be very multidimensional. Sometimes they're surprisingly shallow, but sometimes they're surprisingly sophisticated. So somebody can be very fancy looking and then they start to interact with them and they're just completely uninterested. Whereas I would say that males usually aren't that way.
Well, later in the article, it says that the girlfriend was found later in the car with Jack Nicholson. Later, they were in a car crash, and she crawled out of the sunroof and said, "I have a boyfriend. I can't be here. Don't photograph me."
Oh well, there you go.
Yeah.
All right. Weak knees delta after all.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like I thought that what you were saying was like, oh, if you're a six and you somehow managed to pair bond with an eight, then, you know, if a 10 comes on to her and it's her type, like you really, that's not your competition essentially. And not much you can do if that happens to sway her away,
sure.
But your competition is people in your peer group, essentially in your league, I guess, if you will.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And and also there's all kinds of factors are going into this, obviously. Even in a bizarre situation where a six is pair bonded to an eight, there's usually a damn good reason why that's taking place. It's because the eight is super interested in some consistency, resources, protection, provision, and there's a lot of cues coming from the six on those dimensions. And so some 10 sweeping in behind weak knees delta, if the girl was that susceptible to that generally, that she probably would have never been with the six in the first place. So we start to get some little probability processes that we could put into a computer and make some guesses here. You are correct though. The general strategy is to see to it that we are not being played. If you're a female, you're not being played behind casual mating strategy. You send appropriate signals that what you're interested in is pair bond strategy. By being quite conservative, you are not going to run off a pair bonder. That's not going to happen. Okay, so the only people you're going to run off are going to be casual mating strategy players. And so, by doing so, the pair bonder, this makes you more valuable to the pair bonder because you are a better long-term investment. You're like an insurance company that has a very high rating. Okay, you know, it's not like we couldn't get conflicts of interest with that insurance company, but they've got a very high rating, and so we want to, you know, if we're gonna sink a bunch of resources into something, we'd like to know that it's a solid investment, and that's exactly what a conservative pair bond behaving female looks like, and so that's an intelligent signal to send if you're looking for a long-term relationship.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. The sentiment that I had gotten from some of the male listeners of this show, especially when we first started the show, because I was posting some of the episodes online in some forums that were more geared towards men's dating problems. And the sentiment was, well, why should I put an effort? Why should I put an effort to try to pair bond a female? if she's just going to turn around and just sleep willingly with a guy who's 40% more attractive than me. So why bother, essentially?
Right.
And let's just focus on casual mating strategy rather than trying our best and still being, you know, worth it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's a bit of an ego trap.
Obviously, a completely convoluted strategy. Mm-hmm. No, obviously, if a female pair bond situation and is happy to be there, she wouldn't be there. So that's the whole point. So the female can only be pregnant once in a given period of time. So they're generally not real interested in having a pair bond relationship with some casual relationship on the side. Not particularly. I mean, it's in the genes to have some of that take place, but it's not a predominant feature of female psychology, whereas it's a much more dominant feature of male psychology. So a lot of times using their own intuition about what's going on inside the other person's head can lead us astray, because you don't necessarily have great intuition about what's going on inside of females' heads, and females don't have great intuition about what's going on inside of males' heads. So as a result, that's why it's useful to actually learn a little bit about these sexual dynamics so that we can make better decisions for our long-term best interests.
Fantastic. Thank you for clarifying. All right. We got a caller on hold, so I'm going to check the caller here. Caller, this is Nate G with the Beat Your Genes podcast and Dr. Doug Lyle. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? Caller going once. Caller going twice. And booted out of here. All right.
All right.
Very good.
I think try again.
Yeah, we'll try again.
What else
I put them on hold. So, caller, if you're on hold and you actually, sometimes people call in just to listen to the show, and I don't know that. So, if that's you, then stay on hold. I've just kept you on hold. If you do actually want to ask a question, just hang up, call again, then I'll see you hang up and call again. So, all right, Dr. Lyle, the most random things are considered manly. This is the next question, such as eating a lot, drinking alcohol, or even impressive bodily emissions. I'm sorry. Are these things valid fitness indicators in their own small way, or is it simply just men and highly testosterized individuals making a competition out of literally anything?
So eating a lot, drinking a lot, and making a lot of noise, expelling air?
Yeah.
Is that what we're saying? Yeah.
Both verbally or otherwise,
Right. I think some of this is actually probably – signals, these are probably fitness indicators. And so some of this is going to be signals of your size. And so obviously, if you eat a lot, you drink a lot, and you make a lot of noise, you're probably a bigger human. And bigger is, in principle, sexier. So that's probably why that is. And I think that I've never looked at any of, for example, David Buss's research. I don't recall seeing physical size per se being trying to be signaled by those types of behaviors. But we probably, if we started looking for it, we would probably see it. We would probably see, for example, some guy trying to impress a female might be in a situation where he eats more just to look like he's got a, you know, he's a big, strong guy with a big appetite. Female might go the opposite direction on that, quite different. So that's what I think is probably true. However, I don't know any other evidence for that other than that all kinds of size cues and the way that people display those size cues definitely work that direction. In other words, males are trying to look bigger, taller, wider, stronger. The very fashion of a suit is meant to sculpt the male as if he has very strong shoulders and therefore has a triangular torso. And that's why when they try to make a feminist process about this and have females do this, you know, I don't know, in the 1980s, it backfired fashion-wise. Like males can't stand the look of females in suits with square shoulders. That fashion choice and design is no accident. That's to make males look like they have more impressive torsos, i.e. larger. So, and they're wanting to be, you know, taller, bigger, stronger, et cetera. These are obvious, and I believe all these noises and behaviors are just correlates to that.
All right, Dr. Lyle, it looks like we're going to get some emails about women in suits now.
Nah.
I love it. So,
yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, so actually, I mentioned this last week about setting up a monitored voicemail box for the show. So let me tell everybody the phone number. So if you guys have any comments, concerns, you just want to yell at us, just leave us a message. Yeah. The number I set up is 714-900-2601. So it's 714-900-2601. That's to leave a voicemail when it's not show hours. If you have a question, comment, concern, or a witty comment.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, yeah, you know, and this actually reminded me of you were saying about size. I think we talked about this on the show a couple of years ago, which is that drinking high amounts of alcohol actually functions as a short-term mating strategy. And this is an article published in the Evolutionary Psychology Journal. And it was an experiment showing that females monitor the males engaging in this drinking behavior as a fitness indicator. So if they don't pass out, then that means they have good genes. They don't get drunk as quickly.
Yeah.
So, and they're actually going to be mating more with the young men who are able to handle more alcohol.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's would totally make sense. It's obviously a handicapping strategy on their ability to talk and walk. And so, that makes perfectly reasonable.
All right.
Yeah. Good thing I didn't try that strategy.
But, you know, apple juice looks peculiarly like beer, and that's what my strategy was in college.
There you go. I'll just go in with a half a gallon of apple juice, and you know, keep that in my gym bag that I bring into the bar. That's a good idea. All right, what else we got?
All right, Dr. Lyle, this is about interviewing candidates. And I know you've talked about this from the candidate side about when you do an interview to give the person interviewing you status and a signal to them that they have to earn your esteem, but that, you know, you will be looking out for their status as well.
Yeah.
So Dr. Lyle, I work in finance, and along with my coworkers, I will start interviewing candidates for an additional coworker position. For my own sake, I'd like to hire an agreeable coworker. What's the best way to test for agreeability in a job interview? All the candidates, keep in mind, all the candidates will be able to speak English, but it will not always be as a native language. Additionally, how would you test for conscientiousness in this situation? I remember you answered a similar question in a previous podcast, but I'm interviewing for a relatively high skilled position where you won't find people who can't keep a job or apartment for longer than 6 months. So that trick may not work here.
Okay. Let's think about this. So I want you to read the whole thing back to me once, Nate, because I want to make sure I understand it. Go ahead.
Okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, I work in finance, and along with some coworkers, I will start interviewing candidates for an additional coworker position very shortly.
Okay, understanding now is that, got it. So I was a little confused. He's not interviewing coworkers for a position. He and a bunch of coworkers are going to be interviewing brand new candidates.
Correct. Yeah.
That's what it looks like. Okay. And what we're trying to get is we want to get agreeable people and highly conscientious people. That's what we want.
That's right.
Okay. So, and this is high level stuff. So, we are looking for, we're trying to smoke out who's highly agreeable and highly conscientious. Because i.e. who's going to be really good to work with. Now, one of the things that I would probably do, I'm just trying to think this off the top of my head. I've never thought this one through. The one thing that I'm looking for in the discussion is I'm looking for any place where the I would set a trap probably. If I was really determined to do this well, I would probably set a trap by saying something that is, I might say something that is a little bit wrong. So I'm not sure how I would do that because I don't know about the industry, but I would say something that is, I would try to think of something that might actually be a little bit of a mistake. Okay. It might even be misremembering somebody's name. Who's the CEO of Apple or something. So I would find a way to try
Tim
to.
Apple, right? Yeah. Sorry, I couldn't help it.
Okay. All right. So I would think about a little mistake, and then I would see if anybody rushed to correct me. So I'd be looking for essentially the willingness to contradict, and willingness to contradict is going to be a good signal of disagreeable, but that will be otherwise be cloaked pretty heavily in an interview where people are trying to look agreeable and conscientious. I would also ask them about in previous teams that they've worked on, what were some strengths of the team and the leadership? And then I also ask for some of the weaknesses of the teams and the leadership. And so I would be looking for anybody that waxes a little long complaining about the previous management. And again, it doesn't matter that they might be completely legitimate, but the fact that they would complain is indicative of disagreeable personalities. So that again would be a trap that I would set. And let's see, other than that, obviously, we're looking at people's records. We're looking at how stable they've been. If someone, the less stable a person has been just in general, there's a good chance that we're seeing signals of instability that could be due to disagreeability or lower conscientiousness. So we would ask people kind of what went on in the previous jobs and what led them to their changes. They will be very well ready for those. However, the more stable somebody has been, the more likely it is that they're going to be reasonably good to work with. So all things being equal, I would take the person with the more stable track record as opposed to the less stable track record. So these are the little things that I would do. Specifically this issue of contradiction. If I was really determined to do this, folks, which I can't see that I would, because I think I can read people's faces, facial expressions, warmth, et cetera, pretty well. So I'm going to be able to determine a lot about people's agreeableness just by the nature of the conversation, and their conscientiousness by the nature of the conversation and by their track records, et cetera, and how they answer the questions. But if I was super determined, I would set little traps. And I would set little traps like the issue of I would embed the question of the weakness of previous management in a broader context of a general survey and of what were the strengths and what were the weaknesses of some of the team. You know, where was there any weaknesses in the product or et cetera, what they could have done differently. I'm looking for the sheer amount of verbiage that would be associated with criticism. And the more criticism they give you, the more disagreeable they are. A really agreeable person says, well, we just every day did well and boss was really good and everything was fine. And no, it just so turned out that, you know, that this or that happened in my life and circumstances and the right move was, you know, to look for something different. That's all. So they would be keeping their mouth shut about that problem. That's what I think. That's what I would do.
All right. Fantastic. Yeah, I remember, I believe it was either a lecture at True North or your Perfect Personality DVD where you describe the different personalities and how some people just signal them immediately. And you were in the line of the DMV and the lady asks you if you have your insurance card. And you said, yes, I do. I said, well, can I see it? I said, well, it's in the car. She goes, well, then you don't have your insurance card. Right away, disagreeable.
Right. Oh, yeah. People are signaling it with their facial expression, with their posture, with their hand movements, all kinds of things. And so it's not like this is difficult to determine if you're looking for it very hard. But we can set these little tests for people if we are determined to look for them. And, you know, we could be wrong, but in general, people will fall into these things. And if we have 8 candidates that we're looking at, and we're trying to pick the winner, there's a really good chance that we won't pick the loser if we use this kind of strategy.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that agreeable people are better at picking up agreeable cues and disagreeable people are better at picking up disagreeable cues? Or am I just thinking about it in a different way?
I don't think that that's true, but it's possible. So I understand the underlying logic there that you're looking at. A disagreeable mm-hmm. person is going to inherently be more reactive to to sort of disagreeable feedback, and so they should have a little more sensitive trigger possibly. That might work that way, or agreeable people might be very sensitive because they by being so nervous about pleasing other individuals, you see. So this mm-hmm. is really actually a good research question, Nathan, and I am not aware of the answer. So, yeah, sorry about that.
No worries.
Yeah.
And the other question, too, has to do with openness. Do highly open people, do they have more mirror neurons, or do they just simply have been exposed to more things, and so therefore they're more attuned to those subtle changes?
No, I think actually more open people, I mean more agreeable people, probably have more mirror neurons.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that this is true, but I think that's true. Mm-hmm. So the openness is a different animal. The openness mm-hmm. is just less anxiety over risks that most of us would, you know, they simply aren't seeing the CB the way everybody else is seeing it, and they've just got higher risk tolerance. So it's a different kind of creature.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd never thought about less anxiety. I always thought it was the desire to seek novelty, and so I guess.
No, it's what these things are is they're all CBs on sort of classic problems for the genetic code. Should the animal go further or stay closer to home? Answer: if you have less anxiety, you are, if you're in the tail end of the bell curve, for example, that rabbit is going way too far from the rabbit hole. It's misreading the actual cost benefit analysis for that adventure, and so that's what's happening. It's an outlier. It's got a distorted view of the underlying cost benefit. The rabbit that's in the middle of the bell curve on openness, going the right distance from the rabbit hole as it runs the CB on how far it should go, looking for carrots or mates or a better rabbit hole. Okay, so the ones that are running the risk analysis properly are the genes that built those brains are the genes that are the most prominent in the gene pool. That's why that's the middle of the bell curve. Okay, so as we go on either side of the bell curve symmetrically from that midline, We're looking at genetic variations that are not as successful for that particular habitat. So very open people in general, they've obviously occasionally a person that's very open will hit a jackpot, and the safer and safer the world gets, the more and more people are going to the gene pool is going to drift towards more and more openness. You know, in the next 1,000 years. The species is going to be quite a bit more open than it is now as the world gets increasingly safer. So, but right now, what you see is what you see, and you're going to see, you probably have already seen, social habitats sculpt, the genetic code for openness already. And I'm sure that, if we were to do cross-cultural analysis and look at, cultural histories and risk reward ratios of openness, it's probably already in gene pools already. So, but that's, I have no doubt that that's true. So, in fact, I know it's true. people all over the world.
We talked about this a little bit more detail, because there was a question that was on the list for tonight that's on the bottom. So I just sent it to you, but it's about, the question actually is asking whether the opposite is going to be true.
Tell me, what's the question?
Yeah. The question is there a link between high openness and a reduction in genetic preference? So the question goes on to say, it seems that the people who are highest in openness are the least likely to get along well with their family and the least likely to have kids. The latter is now a choice given the availability of birth control. So given the availability of birth control, this listener is curious if this means that a new societal trend is emerging whereby high openness individuals are being selected out. this being a new trend primarily due to birth control, because in the past,
Now that's just that individual's got like some individual that they know in their head, some wide open chick who slept with 80 people and has used birth control and hasn't had any kids. Okay. And told her family to jam it. I'm leaving Kansas and I'm heading to Berkeley. So they've got a specific individual rattling around in their skull rather than any cultural trend. And high open people, I have no doubt, are more likely to be impregnated. Okay. Just as they're just going to, all things being equal, at the same level of conscientiousness as everybody else, the high open person is going to wind up with more sex partners and more times, statistically more likely to be unprotected in their sexuality and then more likely to end up pregnant. So the, I don't think that there's any, I don't think that's an interesting speculation, but I think it's just somebody got a specific individual in their head and they built an argument around it.
Fantastic. All right, Dr. Lyle, last question for the night.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Dr. Lyle, why is it that my family would discourage weightlifting? I don't talk about it often, but when I do, in passing, I get eye rolls. I mean, compared to career success, it's the polar opposite. If I told my mom I got a promotion, she would want to organize a parade. But if I told her I added 50 pounds to my deadlift, well, again, eye rolls. Given that for a male, these two arenas are probably the two that are most likely to affect sexual success, casual and pair bond, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the different reactions experienced here.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's a great question. And remember that sexual selection is going to work in an interesting way. And that is that if an individual female winds up with a quirk that she likes this bird that has like a little orange feather, you know, the little male that has an orange feather coming out of the right side of his head, then she's going to select that guy and have sex with him as opposed to the guy that doesn't have that feather or that little orange feather is less prominent. And so as a result, she's going to pass on, if she winds up having a son, she's going to pass on that big orange feather. And if she has a daughter, she will pass on the preference to have a male mate that has that orange feather. So in this way, sexual selection can run towards a given direction pretty hard within a gene pool, right? Even within a species, but particularly within a gene pool within a species. So so it's going to turn out that there are many fitness indicators that have become popular. And so you can imagine there was a kind of a hokey romance movie that was made. It was a pretty expensive movie. It was an A-list type movie made probably, I don't know, 1965. I'm just guessing. And I think it was called The Seven Hills of Rome or something like this. And it was the story of this singer. He was a famous singer. And I believe he was an American, but he had Italian roots, and he was, you know, an Italian American. And he, somebody out there that's listening knows who this guy is. Anyway, he had a phenomenal voice, and so they made him the lead of this movie, and it was this sort of cheesy romance. But in it, it showed he was looking for a job in Italy, and he's telling the local bar owners and so forth, hey, I'm a singer. You know what I'm saying? You should be willing to pay me to get a gig or something like this. And some Italian person said, no, we don't import singers. We export them. And, and they showed this little montage of this, he's stepping out into the little ghetto like area where people are doing their laundry on their back porches. And every one of these people is singing like a bird, from the little old lady to the young woman to the guy in his wife beater. Like, everybody can sing. And it was kind of, I don't know if there's any truth that Italians can sing on average better than the rest of us, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. And so what we're going to see is that different fitness indicators are going to be more heavily selected in different populations. So, and specifically at the level of an individual gene, individual gene or gene pool, this young man's mother probably was not particularly interested in big, strong men. And so, what she was more focused on, or for whatever reasons, but it could absolutely be sexual selection, that she was more interested in the shrewdness that would come from being successful career-wise in trade. This could absolutely be sexually selected. So therefore, he's looking around at the world and looking at all the people that he might be attracted to, and he's worried about competing. And he sees that body strength and body size is useful as a male because that's another sexual selected characteristic. And therefore he's like, hey, that's what I ought to be doing. But his mother rolls her eyes. Says that's ridiculous. Okay? Because she's seeing that problem through her own genetic eyes. And that's how that could work that way. So that's individuals are carrying around. This is the example, for example, that this would be the equivalent on the other side, because there's been sexual selection in the other direction for female characteristics as well. That two different guys are looking at a female, and the female has either large breasts or small breasts, and one of them's all excited about her shape, and the other one's like, what are you talking about? It's ridiculous. Okay. And so I've actually run into a number of women in my practice over the years that were wrestling themselves over whether or not to get breast enhancements. And oftentimes their boyfriend or husband is saying, no, don't do it. Okay, I was very attracted to you exactly the way you are. Okay, sometimes that's not what they say, but sometimes that is what they say. And the woman can be in cognitive dissonance, feeling like she will increase her market if she gets an enhancement, even though it may not help or it may actually hurt her attractiveness with respect to her mate. So she can be in cognitive dissonance over that problem. So yeah, what this question is unveiling is the fact that there are differences of opinion as to what fitness indicators are most sexy or most important. And a mom could absolutely have a disagreement with a son and roll her eyes as the son pursues a strategy that to her doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Well, I'm not going to try and guess what culture this person's from, but
I don't even try. It's a good way to get into trouble.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
All right. With that, we will end the show before I say anything dumb. All right. Too late.
All right, Nathan. Great talking to you. We'll see everybody soon.
All right. Have a good night, everyone. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.